Okay, so let's just start with an overview of the Parsha. So the Parsha, we have a number of different things this week. The Parsha begins with the mitzvah to kindle the menorah, mitzvah given to Aharon and his sons, and thereafter to kindle the menorah daily in the Mishkan and in the temple and so on. There's a whole section this week's Parsha about sanctifying and preparing the Levim, the Levites, for the service in the Mishkan. We also have a famous piece of Pesach Sheni, the group of people that couldn't bring the Korban Pesach, the Paschal Lamb, and complained that they didn't want to be left out, so Hashem gave them a mitzvah, the second Pesach. We have a section we're dealing with traveling in the Mishkan, how the traveling in the Mishkan from place to place worked. Then we have a piece called the Chatzoitzrois, where the Torah talks about the trumpets. Trumpets that were designed and made in the Midbar, in the desert, for various purposes, like to call the Jewish people, to gather the people. It was blown on Shabbos, on Yontif, on Rosh Chodesh, and so on. The famous paragraph that we sing every time we take out the Torah, Vayihi b'nisay ha'arayin, is also in this week's Parsha, because it's talking about the traveling of the Ark together by Heben Saron means when the Ark travels. We have a section this week where they complain about the man and they want meat, and Hashem tells Moshe Rabbeinu to appoint the 70 elders, which he does by choosing 6 from each tribe, which then made a total of 72, and then of one tribe, 2 had to be left out, and that was Eldad and Medad. But Hashem anyways gave them a spirit of prophecy, and that was the whole introduction to the story of the Lashon Hara that Miriam and Aaron spoke about Moshe Rabbeinu. We have the slav, the meat. And then when Miriam is punished for speaking about Moshe Rabbeinu with leprosy, the entire congregation, the entire Bnei Yisrael, had to wait for her for 7 days until it cleared up. And only then they were able to keep on traveling. Okay. So what I want to do is to learn 2 parts of the parasha. We'll just do a little bit on the first part, which we've done before, and then have a look at a particular verse later on in the parasha. Let's have a look at the beginning of the parasha, page 774, where the Torah says, "Vayedaber Hashem al Moshe lemer." Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu, saying, "Daber el Aaron, speak to Aaron, ve'amarto elav, and say to him, when you kindle the candles and mulpanei menorah facing the menorah, yoiru shivas haneiros, the 7 candles will burn. Vayaskein Aaron, Aaron did that, el mulpanei menorah facing the menorah, ha'ela neiroseha, you kindle the candles, kasher tziva Hashem is Moshe, as Hashem had commanded Moshe Rabbeinu to do. And then the Torah goes on and tells us that this is how the menorah was made. Mikshah Zohar was made out of one piece of gold. Ad Yerecha, Ad Pirsha, Mikshah, from the top to the bottom, it was all one piece of solid gold. Kamare, like the vision, Asher Hera Hashem, this Moshe that Hashem had shown Moshe Rabbeinu, Kain Osas HaMenorah, that's the way the menorah was made. Okay. Now, one of the famous things about this parsha is where it comes. It comes at the back of the end of last week's parsha, and I just want to share with you something, a famous concept, but then add to it. At the end of last week's parsha, Parshas Nosoi, we have the dedication of the Mizbeach. The Mishkan was erected, and the 12 tribes, the 12 Nisim, the 12 leaders of the tribe, decided to dedicate the Mizbeach, which Hashem accepted. And the way it was done is that the first 12 days of Nisan, each leader of each tribe brought a set of sacrifices to dedicate the Mizbeach. And that was considered a very, very major yontif, a beautiful thing, a beautiful celebration, which, by the way, is the reason that the first 12 days of Nisan, we don't say Tachnun, they're considered days of yontif, and then it's it's part of what makes last week's parasha the longest parasha in the Torah. Because it's repeated every day, we have the repetition of how each tribe brought a korban. So Rashi brings from Chazal, from the Tanchuma, from the Medrash, the famous Medrash, that there was a 13th tribe, and that's the tribe of Levi. Don't forget, in all together, we always talk about the 12 tribes, but actually there were 13 tribes. It's interesting that the Torah always talks about 12 tribes, because that 12 number is a specific number, it's an important number. So when the tribe of Levi gets counted, then Yosef is counted as one tribe, because 12 sons of Yaakov. But normally when the tribes of Klal Yisrael are enumerated in the Chumash, Yosef is enumerated as two, because don't forget, Yaakov gave a special bracha that his two sons, Menashe and Ephraim, would be considered as two separate, distinct tribes. And therefore, when all the tribes get enumerated, normally Levi is kept out and done separately. For example, in the census, right? So the census was, that we read about the beginning of 2 weeks ago, in the beginning of Bamidbar, all the tribes are counted, 12 tribes. 12 tribes, and Levi is not counted, because Levi was, the census of Levi was done differently, different age, done separately, and so on and so forth. So when it comes to the dedication of the Mizbeach, we read about the 12 tribes dedicating the Mizbeach, but there was a 13th tribe, and that was a tribe of Levi, right? And the leader of the tribe of Levi was Aaron HaKohen. Even though he was a Kohen, but he came from the tribe of Levi, right? Says the Medrash that when Aaron HaKohen saw that all the tribes were contributing and being part of the dedication of the Mizbeach, he kind of felt bad. How come his tribe has no contribution, has no specific contribution in the dedication of the Mizbeach? Right? Because he wasn't included. Comes along Hashem and says, Shalcha gedoyla mishalahem. I'm going to give you something that's greater than what the other tribes contributed. And what's that? The mitzvah of kindling the menorah. That's what the Medrash says. That's why we have this mitzvah right away at the beginning of Baal Yischa, which is actually a bit out of place, because the Torah talks about kindling the menorah elsewhere in the Torah. So it comes here because it's right after that whole thing of the dedication of Mizbeach, and Hashem is promising that you'll have a special part in the dedication of Mizbeach, which is kindling the menorah. So the Mefarshim will ask, and the Ramban, the very, very famous Ramban, says the following. He says, what does that mean? Because the Medrash says that Hashem told Aaron that the reason yours is greater than theirs is because what they are involved in is sacrifices, korbanos. Korbanos are finite, they're going to come to an end. What I'm giving you is eternal. Says the Ramban, what do you mean? Korbanos are in the Beis HaMikdash. When the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, the korbanos came to an end, the sacrifice came to an end. So did the menorah. The kindling of the menorah doesn't happen today, just like sacrifices don't happen today. So why is Aaron's better? Says the famous Ramban, that when Hashem gave him the mitzvah of kindling the menorah, that was alluding to the mitzvah of Hanukkah. But when the Beis HaMikdash came to an end, the menorah, the kindling of the menorah, so to speak, the kedusha, the holiness of the candles of the menorah continued on in the kindling of the Hanukkah candles. And that's why his is eternal. And that's why his is greater than theirs, and that was his consolation. That's a famous idea, and I think we've mentioned this before. What I wanted to share with you is an interesting comment made by the Sochachova, the Shema Shmuel, and explains the following. Why, what's the specific connection between this mitzvah of kindling the menorah and the tribe of Levi? See, what's interesting is that the Nossi, the leader of the tribe of Levi, was Aaron the Kohen, as we said, right? Yet he was a Kohen, and he was leading the tribe of Levim. Now, it's the same tribe, because Kohanim and Levim come from the same tribe. But yet the Kohanim were kind of extracted from the tribe of Levi, and they treated separately. They're a separate bunch. And his explanation gives an interesting insight to what Aaron wanted. In fact, it's an interesting lesson of leadership also, what Aaron wanted for the rest of his tribe. Because he explains, which is a concept that's explained often in Kabbalistic writings and so on, that actually the role, the spiritual role, shall we say, of Kohanim and Levim were actually very different. Kohanim and Levim were all from the tribe of Levi. The tribe of Levi was chosen to be a special tribe. This was going all the way back. Don't forget, the tribe of Levi was the one tribe that didn't work in Mitzrayim. Right? They were the ones that kept learning Torah during Mitzrayim. They didn't have a portion of the land of Eretz Yisrael. They were Torah teachers. The whole tribe of Levi were kind of singled out for like spiritual leadership for the whole Klal Yisrael. And they were different. They were always different. Tribe of Levi. More specifically, however, the tribe of the Levim and the Kohanim had a very different spiritual role. Now, it doesn't say this, but actually it's connected to what it's often explained in Kabbalah, that Kohanim are Chesed and Levim are Gvura. Right? Chesed and Gvura. Now, one of the distinctions between Chesed and Gvura is Chesed, like water, for example, is considered Chesed. Why? Because water is a giving thing. It flows from on top to the bottom. It's Hashem's gift. It's like concept of giving. When Hashem gives us things, when we receive from Hashem, that's an expression of Chesed, right? Gevura is a very different sort of mindset or context. Gevura is about moving away from something. So we have an interesting concept in our relationship with Hashem. There's two parts. One part is bringing heaven down to earth, so to speak, meaning bringing Kedusha, bringing godliness down to this world. That's one idea. The other idea is elevating ourselves from the world closer to God. It's called Hamshacha and Hala, coming down and moving up. Both are important. Both have their advantages. It doesn't go into great detail, but that's the concept. Ultimately, the concept is to bring Hashem into the world. However, sometimes you can bring Hashem into the world and the world stays the same. The world intrinsically doesn't change, and that's not good. To give you an example, one analogy that's given for, we call this idea of Amshach, of bringing something down, is let's say the rays of the sun. The rays of the sun are a strong light. And the rays of the sun are very strong, so it can illuminate, as long as there's no clouds in the way, it can illuminate everything. So you can have rays of the sun shining into this room, you can have rays of the sun shining into the garbage heap, into the bathroom, anywhere. The rays of the sun can shine anywhere. In other words, the rays of the sun are so strong that they can illuminate any type of environment, which is true, but the environment doesn't change. The garbage dump remains a garbage dump, right? For that, you need work from the bottom. You need the concept of hala. You need the concept of elevation. Same thing. We can sometimes do mitzvahs, we can bring lots of kedusha into the world, but we haven't changed. And part of the whole purpose of creation is not just to bring Hashem into the world, it's for us to become a place where Hashem is comfortable. For that to be, we have to change. We have to elevate ourselves. Right? To give you another example, it's the difference between Torah and davening. Torah is when we bring Hashem's word into our reality. Davening is when we speak to Hashem and we elevate ourselves. Right? And that is also the difference between Chesed and Gvura. So Hashem's Kedusha coming into this world is a concept of Chesed. Hashem shines into the world, sends us doses of holiness. That's Chesed. However, elevation is a concept of Gvura. It's us moving away from worldliness, us moving away from the mundane. That's the concept of Gvura. Now, in serving Hashem, it's the difference between Kohanim and Levim. Kohanim, their purpose is to bring Hashem into the world. They worked in the Mizbeach, they brought Karbonis, they brought the Shechina, the divine presence, down here to this world. That was the mission of the Kohanim. Every single day in the Beis HaMikdash, the Kohanim did things to bring the Shechina, to bring the divine presence into this world. What was the role of the Levim? They sang. They were there to sing. What's singing? It's like davening. Singing is about drawing the Neshama away from the world. Singing is an expression of elevation. Even today, we sing by davening. Because davening is this concept where we express our soul. We try to move away from the mundane reality. That's the concept of singing. So Aaron HaKohen has a look at the dead. This is what his insight is, a very interesting insight. Aaron HaKohen has a look at the dedication of the Mizbeach, and he wants the tribe of Levi to be part of it as well. But he doesn't want them, it's a little bit of a different twist. He wasn't upset that they weren't part of the sacrifices, because the truth is they were part of the sacrifices. The Kohanim were helping the Yidden bring the sacrifices. What he wanted was, he wanted sacrifices, he says, belongs to me, but I want something for my tribe. I want something for the Levim as Levim. I'm a Kohen. I'm fine with bringing down the Shechem down here. But that's not the role of the Levi. The role of the Levi is halo, elevation. I want something for the Levim. I want something that will express, notwithstanding that I'm a Kohen, or I'm the Kohen Gadol, I want something that will contribute to the Mishkan that's an expression of what the Levi stands for. Hashem says, you're right. I'm going to give you the mitzvah of kindling the menorah. Kindling the menorah was also done by the Kohen, but it was more of a Levi experience than a Kohen experience. It's lighting the candle. The candle is a symbol of the soul. The candle is a symbol of the soul elevating. The soul, it says in many, many places that the candle of fire burning, the reason why the neshama is compared to a candle, as we always say, we light neshama candles and all this kind of stuff. Why? Because the neshama is like a candle. Just like a candle, you light a flame. If there's no wick and oil, it doesn't stay. Because the flame is always jumping upwards. It actually wants to leave the candle. That's why a flame flickers. It's the oil and the wick that holds it down. But actually the flame is always trying to go away. Like our neshama. Our neshama is stuck down here because it's connected to a candle and a wick and oil, which is the guf, the body and the mitzvahs and so on, which we have to do in the physical world. But the neshama in its own right actually has this burning desire to move away from the world, to become more connected to its original source, which is godliness. And that's the menorah. The menorah is for the Kohen to light the menorah, and in fact in many places it's explained that the idea of lighting the menorah every day was to reignite the soul, because sometimes that yearning of the soul becomes so buried in the mundaneness of the body that it's dormant. And it's important. Of course it's important to remain in this world, but it's also important to want to move away from the world. It's important to be elevated, because you need the combination. And that's why Aaron HaKohen was given this mitzvah, which the essence of this mitzvah is done by the Kohanim, but it's in essence a Levi role. It's to elevate, not to bring the Shekhinah down here, it's to elevate the Neshama upwards. Hashem says, that's your contribution. Because you, the Nosi of Levi, you, the Nosi of the tribe of Levi, I'm giving you something specific for the tribe of Levi, which will be their contribution to the dedication of the Mizbeach. He doesn't say this, but I was thinking before, it's an unbelievable lesson in leadership also. A true leader doesn't try to mold the people who he follows into his own mold. A true leader does what they need, what the people need. Lifting them, elevating them, inspiring them, but what they need in terms of exercising and realizing their mission. For Aaron, it wasn't a menorah thing. Aaron was korbanos more, but he wanted something for his tribe, the tribe of Levi, who weren't Kohanim. What they needed, and they needed a mitzvah like the menorah. Okay. Still staying in this section, before we move away, there's a very interesting pasuk which I've talked about before. But I wanted to share with you another insight into it. The famous pasuk that says, if you look at pasuk Gimel, the third verse, page 774 in the Arch Kol Chumash. So it says, Aaron got this instruction by Ya'as Kain Aaron, and Aaron did what he was told, and he kindled the menorah. So the famous Rashi. It says, what is the pasuk trying to tell us? That Aaron did what he was told. Lahagid shvacha, it came to praise Aaron. They didn't change, he didn't deviate from what Hashem told him to do. And of course, all the mefarshim asked the question, what kind of praise is this? What kind of business is this? Aaron is given a mitzvah, he's given instructions, and you know what? He was such a religious Jew that he meticulously carried out what Hashem told him to do. You need an Aaron HaKohen for that? I mean, he was specifically told what to do. Obviously, he's not going to change. What's, right? So many, many mefarshim, I think the ones I've quoted in the past is this. That one of the, it's a nice lesson in itself, but I want to go into something else, but I want to just revise that concept. That what does it mean he didn't change? He didn't change his excitement. You know, the difference between doing a mitzvah the first time and the 100th time is passion. Why do we make Shechiyonu on a new yontif, on a new mitzvah? Because the first time we do it, we're all excited, right? First time a mitzvah boy puts on tefillin, phew. If you ever saw a mitzvah boy put on tefillin, it's like one of the most exciting things. When they're 35, it's not so exciting anymore. It's like you got to get up in the morning, you got to go to minyan. You still do it, a committed Jew, but it's not so exciting, right? It says, Vayas Kain Aaron, Aaron did this, says Rashi, to praise Aaron, and he did not change. What does it mean he didn't change? Not that he didn't change the halachas. He didn't change his excitement. That the first time Aaron must have kindled the menorah, can you imagine? The first time this mitzvah, the menorah is ready, Aaron is about to kindle it. You know, you make a big party, a big suda to thank Hashem for arriving at this new idea. And this mitzvah says the Torah, that excitement remained every single day. Aaron never ever changed from that passion. Okay, that's the famous pshat. But I want to just give you a little bit of another insight. What does it mean Aaron didn't change? That he was as involved and he took his participation in this mitzvah very, very seriously. What does that mean? So an interesting insight with an important lesson. If you look at the history of how the Mishkan was made, we find an interesting thing with the menorah. The menorah had to be made out of one solid piece of gold. It was a very difficult design. And Rashi says in Parashas Truma, and we learn in Chazal, that actually Moshe Rabbeinu didn't actually know what to do. He didn't actually know how to make the menorah. So Hashem said, no problem, I'll make the menorah for you. Throw the gold into the fire, out came the menorah. What does that mean? There are certain things that human beings can achieve, and certain things human beings cannot achieve. And we can only get them if we're given a gift from Hashem. The menorah is a symbol of those things that we cannot do, that we cannot build, we cannot achieve. There are certain levels, certain spiritual heights, certain spiritual achievements and accomplishments that us as human beings, the biggest tzaddik, the greatest avodas Hashem, the greatest commitment to serving God, will not achieve. Because these are things that are, by definition, transcendent. They're higher than us, they're higher than human reach on any level, and they cannot be achieved by the human being. They can only be connected to if Hashem gives us that gift. In the Mishkan, we have these two ideas. Part of the Mishkan is built by the human being, instructions from God, but we build it, we can achieve it, we can create that home for Hashem. The menorah we couldn't build, it's too difficult. What does it mean it's too difficult? The pshat is because it was represented a connection to God which actually is beyond human reach, which is why the menorah had to be made by God, it couldn't be made by us. Because the menorah is symbolic of those things which human beings cannot achieve on their own. It has to be received by a gift from Hashem. Oh. So one could think, if that's the case, with those things in Yiddishkeit that need to be completely given to us as a gift, the human involvement is not that important. That's what we could think. Anyways, I can't achieve it. When I have to do a mitzvah, which I'm told that the mitzvah has a direct link to the consequence which is going to happen out of the mitzvah, so I understand. I've got to be excited about it. I've got to be passionate about it. I've got to keep it to the last letter of the law. I've got to pay unbelievable focus and attention to doing that mitzvah because it's my mitzvah which is accomplishing whatever spiritual accomplishment is going to be. But if I get told that what I'm doing is not really that important anyway, because the consequence of this particular mitzvah is to achieve something which really I cannot achieve. Anyways, it's a gift from Hashem. So why am I that important? So I don't have to be so focused. I don't have to be so involved. That's the mistake one could make. Comes along the Chumash and said, Aaron HaKohen understood that it's not true. Vayas Kein Aaron, even though it was a mitzvah of the menorah, and the menorah is symbolic of a gift from Hashem, we praise Aaron that he gave it his full attention. He didn't change, he didn't deviate, he gave it complete focus, complete immersion, complete enthusiasm, complete passion, complete excitement. Why? How come? Because this teaches us a very, very fundamental thing. And let me just show, I'll explain it to you by showing you something on the handout. A very fundamental principle. There's a Maimer Chazal, a Chazal, I think it's a Masechta Kiddushin, if I'm not mistaken. So the Chazal tell us like this. It's a sentence in the Gemara that highlights the importance of effort. Right? So it says like this. Anyone have a handout?
Yes.
We need spare ones, though. Okay, you sure? Oh, yeah. So it says like this. If someone will tell you, Yogaiti v'loi motzasi, I worked hard but I have not been successful, Al-Tamin, don't believe. That's ridiculous. People work hard, they get success. That's what it is. It's talking about in Torah, actually, more. The specific reference here is in Torah, that if you work hard in Torah study, you will achieve. If someone says, Lo yagaiti matsasi, I didn't work hard and I was successful, Al-Tamin, also don't believe it. Nothing comes without hard work. However, if someone says, Yogaiti umatsasi, someone says, I have worked hard and I've been successful, tell me that's a person who you can believe. Does that make sense? Hard work brings results. Okay, fine. However, the translation I just gave you is not accurate. I mean, that's what the English translation translates, and that's what, contextually, that's what it means. If someone says, I've worked hard and been successful, you can believe that person. But success in Hebrew is hatzlacha. So it should say, Yogaiti, I worked hard, vehitzlachti, and I had hatzlacha. It doesn't say that. What does it say? It says, Yogaiti, if someone says, I've worked hard, umatsasi, and I have found. Found. What does that mean, to find? Find what? So you know what the word metzia means in Hebrew? The way it's used in Yiddish. What does it mean? A bonus. Right? Like if someone goes to the thing and you find something that should be very, very expensive for a quarter of the price. What do you say? I found a metzia. Right? Where does that word come from? It's a Yiddish expression. Where does it come from? It comes from the Gemara. Because in the Gemara, when it talks about the laws of lost and found objects, and it talks about when someone goes in the street and finds something completely unexpected, the word is metzia. He found a metzia. He found something. Right? So the word find in Hebrew, classical Hebrew, at least Gemara language, is a reference to something that is completely unexpected, which completely doesn't fit into what the Gemara is telling us. It's trying to teach us the relationship between hard work and results. So what does it tell us? Yogaiti, I worked hard. Umatsasi, and I found something completely unexpected. That doesn't make sense. It's supposed to be, I found something as a result of my hard work. So why does it say it? So the pshat is like this. The Torah is telling us like this, in particularly in areas of serving Hashem. Hashem doesn't only reward us or give us things in proportion to what we put in. No. Hashem gives us metzias. Hashem gives us gifts. Gifts that we cannot achieve on our own. On the one hand. He gives us metzias. Disproportionate to what we put in. However, He only gives it to us if we put in maximum effort. So when we do what we can do, when we reach the level we can reach, Hashem responds. But He doesn't respond proportionally. He responds infinitely greater than what we've achieved, but only when we've achieved it. In other words, when the human being creates a vessel, as much as the human being can possibly create, Hashem gives us a gift. Hashem gives us a metziah. Where's the classic example for this? We've mentioned this before, but it's just something we've just come from. The counting of the Omer. The counting of the Omer represents the refinement of the person, personal growth. 7 times 7, the 7 emotions, each one intertwined with the other 7, so it's the, right? Now, if you look in the Torah, where it tells us to count the Omer, it tells us to count 7 weeks. But we count 49 days, and it tells us in the Torah to count 49 days, but if you have a look in the Torah, it does not say to count 49 days. It says, Tisperu chamishim yom, you should count 50 days. We don't count 50 days. Why? Because it's explained that Shavuos is part of the whole equation. What is 49? So we know that the number 50 is a number of transcendence. 49 is the human cycle. The elevation, the personal growth, the refinement of 49, even at its perfect state, is as much as a Jew can achieve in this world. You can only reach, even if you're really good, you can only reach the 49th level. Even if you do it with perfection. The 50th level, we say, we are taught in Gemara, there are Nun Share Bino, it's called the 50 gates of understanding. Great levels. The 50th one is actually beyond our reach. So that's why when it comes to Shavuos, we don't count the 50th day, because counting means what we can achieve. On the other hand, the Torah says to count 50 days. Why? Because the Torah says, what it means is like this. The goal is to reach the 50th level. But the 50th level is one you cannot reach. It's one I'm going to have to give to you, says Hashem. But when am I going to give it to you? Only if you count the first 49. So you count the first 49, you've done what you can. 50th day is Shavuos. I give you the 50th as a gift. Only after the 49. That's what's considered part of the counting. Although we don't count because it's not a human achievement. Same thing here. Yogaiti v'loi motzasi. If a person says, I put in the effort, but I didn't find a metzia, don't believe him. Because you guide to your metzasi, if you put in the effort, and then you found not just what you put in effort for, but you found a metzia, you found completely unexpected results, you can believe that person. Because that's what hard work brings. Hard work brings results not just proportionate to the hard work. Hard work brings results disproportionate to the hard work. Much greater. So that's the whole thing. That's the lesson Aaron tells us over here. Hashem gives Aaron a mitzvah to kindle the menorah. So Aaron could think to himself, hold on a second, the menorah is a symbol of a gift. The menorah is a symbol of something Hashem gives us as a gift. So therefore, my involvement is not that critical, says the Torah. No, by Yaskein Aaron. Aaron got fully involved in the process. He knew he was involved in something which anyways he can't achieve. Yes, but he was also aware he can't achieve it. It's a gift from Hashem, but he'll only achieve it and get that gift once he puts in maximum effort. That's why Lhagid Shifra, it's to tell Aaron tell us the praise of Aaron, that he understood this idea. He didn't change anything. He got fully involved and focused because he realized that only then he could receive what the menorah symbolizes, which is a gift from Hashem. Just what I share with you, it's an insight I came across this year. It's a nice insight into this concept. Okay. Let's move a little bit into something else in the parasha. Have a look at a very, very famous pasuk. Page 794. In the Ashkel Chumash, page 794. It comes just after Miriam and Aaron said something about Moshe Rabbeinu, which on their level was considered Lashon Hara. Miriam was punished because she initiated the discussion. And then the Torah tells us a very famous pasuk. Pasuk Gimel, the third verse in chapter 12. The Torah says, Ve'ish Moshe, this man Moshe, Moshe Rabbeinu, Onav Ma'od was extremely humble. Mikol Ha'odom Asher Al Pnei Ha'odom. More than all people on the face of the earth. That's what it means, Mikol Ha'odom. Mikol Ha'odom, from all people, meaning he was humble than all people, more humble than everyone that exists. Famous pasuk, right? First of all, interesting, why does the Torah say, Ve'ha'ish Moshe? This man Moshe, why can't I just say, Moshe? What's this Ish Moshe mean? What's this idea of Ish Moshe? Right? Sorry? Yeah, but we know he's a man. I mean, yeah.
What does it mean?
Right.
Interesting. Making him like a human being, but so elevated.
Okay, that's one idea. But the truth is, the ish can be worked the other way around also. Because, interesting that there are many descriptions for a human being, or even a man. Ish, gever, enoish, right? Ish has a specific meaning. The word ish normally represents strength. And represents almost like a leadership quality. So Torah is telling us the greatness of the humility of Moshe. That even though he was an ish, and the tendency of people is that when they have to be superior to others, or they give to others, or they lead others, leadership is the one thing that's very possible to breed arrogance. Says the Torah, that's the praise of the Moshe Rabbeinu. Not that he was the most humble person of the whole world, that's in itself unbelievable. But he was the most humble human being, even though he was V'ha'ish Moshe. He was a strong leader. Which leads into a pshat I once saw later on in Chumash, before Moshe Rabbeinu passes away. He asks Hashem for a successor. He says to Hashem, I'm not leaving this people without a leader, like a flock without a shepherd. Can you please appoint a new leader to lead these people? Right? Famous passing, Parshas Pinchas, in a few weeks from now. So he says to Hashem, can you appoint Ish Asher Ruach Boy? Appoint an Ish that has the spirit in him, the Spirit Elim is a whole nother discussion. It means Zikri is someone who can embrace diversity, you can understand the differences between people and so on and so forth. But also, they also ask for an Ish. And I saw once a pshat, because the Ish then, once we have this pasuk Ish, Ish now means two things. Ish is associated with strength and leadership, and Ish is associated now with humility. Because now we learn Ish Moshe is onav lo'ei b'kol adam, right? Once we have this pasuk. And that's what Moshe Rabbeinu was asking Hashem. To be a leader of Klal Yisrael needs, and to be a leader anytime really, true leadership requires a very unique quality, a combination which is difficult. A combination of strength, but extreme humility. But it's humility that mustn't come at the expense of strength, because a leader has to be demanding. A leader has to be strong. A leader has to stand up and say, no, this is not right. A leader sometimes has to impose when it's appropriate. At the same time, but that's a recipe for arrogance sometimes. So at the same time, as we have Ish Moshe Onov, so Moshe Ben asked for an Ish later on, he was asking for the combination. So asking has got to be someone who's an Ish, strong leader, but at the same time, very, very humble. Now, I saw an interesting little thought on this from the Tiferes Shleimer, the Radomsky Rebbe. And he says the following, just on this little parsha where it says that Moshe Rabbeinu was humble, and then later we read that Moshe Rabbeinu came out and Hashem appeared to Moshe and Miriam, to Aaron and Miriam, and he sort of reprimanded them. He says, how come you weren't afraid to speak about my servant Moshe? He's someone who's faithful to me, someone who's got open access, open door policy to anything that he wants, and so on and so forth. So the Radomsky Rebbe says a very interesting little insight. He says that in the Medrash, it says, when it talks about Rabbi Akiva, now we know Rabbi Akiva, in a way, was considered the successor of Moshe Rabbeinu to a great extent, because it says that Moshe Rabbeinu revealed to us Torah Shebichsav, the written Torah, and Rabbi Akiva was like the authority on the oral Torah Shebal Peh. There's a famous story, a famous vision that the Gemara talks about, where Hashem showed Moshe Rabbeinu a vision of future generations. And he saw Rabbi Akiva teaching his students. And he saw him teaching something that he didn't know. And he felt like, hold on a second, I thought I'm the guy that got the Torah, right? And he felt sort of weak, it says in the Medrash. And then he saw someone in the classroom asking Rabbi Akiva, where do you know this from? And he says, Halacha l'Moshe m'Sinai. It's a halacha derived from Moshe Rabbeinu at Sinai. So Moshe Rabbeinu felt better. So connected to this is the Medrash, that there were certain things that were revealed to Moshe Rabbeinu, revealed to Rabbi Akiva, so to speak, that weren't in an open way revealed to Moshe Rabbeinu. And there's many, many explanations of trying to understand all what that means. But he gives a very interesting insight. He said, how can that be? Moshe Rabbeinu is the receiver of the entire Torah. The Gemara says that anything anyone innovates in Torah study, at the end of the day, it was all given over to Moshe Rabbeinu, at least in a potential state. How can you say things that were revealed to Rabbi Akiva weren't revealed to Moshe Rabbeinu? So he says like this. He says, Moshe Rabbeinu testifies that he was the most humble person. The Torah testifies that Moshe Rabbeinu was the most humble person, right? Now we know that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote down the Torah. Can you imagine Moshe Rabbeinu writing this pasuk, by the way? It's an interesting experience to write this pasuk that he's the most humble person, right? But he didn't have a choice. He was dictated the Torah, right? And part of that Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu had to write down that was written by dictation from God himself was verses about him. Things like, Ish Moshe Onav Mo'ed Mikolodav, like this pasuk, Moshe Rabbeinu is the most humble person. Psukim, like at the end of the Torah where it says, Kom Novi, there was no prophet that ever rose that was as great as Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay, that's a dispute if Moshe Rabbeinu wrote that or the last eight psukim, actually some say Yeshua wrote. But let's say according to the opinion that he wrote it. But many other things, and the whole paragraph that follows about Hashem reprimanding Miriam and Aaron for Moshe Rabbeinu and so on and so forth. So he says that there was parts of the Torah that deal with Moshe Rabbeinu himself, that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote them down by force. But he didn't spend time exploring their depth. That part he left for others. And he says that's these parts of the Torah that Rabbi Akiva discovered things that weren't revealed to Moshe Rabbeinu. They were given to Moshe Rabbeinu. But Moshe Rabbeinu didn't maximize the full potential in this psukim because of his humility. So he wrote them down, he studied them, and he gave them over. But then he left them. It was Rabbi Akiva who then was able to explore the ultimate depth in these particular paragraphs. Just a nice little thought. Now, let's just, however, just spend the last few minutes just revisiting a concept which we've spoken about before, with an interesting insight of understanding what is this humility that we're talking about. What does it mean, Moshe ben Avraham? So we've always talked about this idea that humility does not mean to feel low. Humility doesn't mean you feel nothing. A person can be humble, even though a person is fully aware of his or her greatness, his or her strengths. It's not a contradiction to feeling humble. Now, this is obviously extremely important when it comes to Moshe Rabbeinu, because Moshe Rabbeinu was fully aware who he was. He was fully aware that he was the person who received the Torah from Sinai. He was fully aware that he was one of the greatest leader. He was fully aware that he was a tzaddik. He was fully aware that he had a connection and a relationship with God that no one else had. So he was fully aware of all these things. And yet, we say that he was the most humble, right? So this humility of Moshe Rabbeinu is explained in different ways. One explanation that's often given, which we'll see the limitation of this explanation, is this. That Moshe Rabbeinu was humble because he understood that everything that he has is God-given, right? And therefore, he felt humble because he felt that he perhaps was given these strengths from Hashem, or these talents, or these amazing gifts that he was given from God, and perhaps he felt he did not maximize them to their full potential. And it's explained in many Mefarshim that Moshe Rabbeinu felt that had these very strengths, had these very talents, the ability to study Torah, the ability to daven, the ability to be a tzaddik, had these strengths been given to other people, maybe they would have done a better job. Right? That's what humility means. Now, it might not be true, but nevertheless, that at least is not false humility. In other words, humility has to have sometimes humility is not accurate, but it's not false. It's two different things, right? I'll give you an example. The Gemara says that there's a famous question that's asked in the book of Tanya, where it brings that talks about tzaddikim and beinonim and rishoyim, right? There's three categories of Jewish people: the righteous, the average, and the beinoni, the middle guy, and then the wicked people. So when it's discussed in the Gemara, the famous great sage, Rabba, says to his colleagues, he says, Kagon ano beinoni. If you want an example of a beinoni, it's me. So Abaya, his friend, got all upset with him. He says, if you're a beinoni, then the rest of us are in real trouble. How can you call yourself a beinoni? Right. And the question is asked, is a bigger question. How can you call yourself a beinoni? That's false humility. What do you mean a beinoni? If a beinoni is how we understand it sometimes, that a beinoni is someone that's got half mitzvahs and half of transgressions, for example, Rabbah knew that wasn't him. Rabbah was a great tzaddik. He was a person that never stopped learning Torah. I mean, he was up there. So how could he say about himself, right? So there's a whole explanation we're going to go into now. There's a whole explanation that a real beinoni doesn't mean that. Rabbah didn't mean that. Rabbah meant a beinoni in a different sense. A beinoni actually is a very, very high level. It means someone who actually never does anything wrong, but yet still has the struggle. He still sometimes has a struggle. So he felt he's not quite a tzaddik. He might be a beinoni at a very high level, but he's still a beinoni. And the explanation that's given from the commentaries is that it was still wrong, because he wasn't a beinoni, he was a tzaddik. But at least it was a mistake that made sense. It wasn't accurate, but it wasn't false. That's what I'm saying. Okay. So Moshe Rabbeinu, to feel humble, he knew that he was the greatest Torah scholar. He knew that he received the Torah from Hashem. He knew that he was the greatest teacher, the greatest leader. And yet he felt humble because he felt, maybe inaccurately, but he felt that had it been given to someone else, they would even do better with it. So the Mefarshim say, that's good. Right? That's good. But it doesn't explain everything. There's one thing that Moshe Rabbeinu was given that no one could have done better with it, because it had nothing to do with him. And that is his level of prophecy. Prophecy is not something you achieve. Prophecy is something you give it. Now, again, it's like before we said, it's only given to certain people. But Moshe Rabbeinu was given a level of prophecy that no other human being ever had. As the Pasuk says, V'leikom Moshe k'novi oid, there will never be and what never was a Novi, a prophet like Moshe Rabbeinu. When it came to prophecy, Moshe Rabbeinu was going to and always will be the greatest. And Moshe Rabbeinu knew that. So how did that fall into his humility aspect? How was he humble together with the prophecy? How did the humility work together with prophecy? Because in prophecy, he couldn't have made that same calculation that if someone else had my capability, they'd be a better prophet. No such thing. Hashem testifies that was the ultimate level of prophecy. No one else could have anything close to it. So how did that fall into Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy? So the Mefarshim explain There's two types of humility. There's a logical humility, and then there's something we call an intrinsic humility. It's what it's called anova al pi cheshbon, which means a humility that is a result of a logical, rationale type of thinking. And then there's an humility which comes essentially. It's an essential humility. To say that if someone else had the talents I have, they'd do a better job, and therefore I feel humble, that's a great thing, but it's humility born out of a logical conclusion. Moshe Rabbeinu reached a greater level of humility. He reached a humility which we call intrinsic humility. In other words, despite the fact that he had a quality over every other human being, that he knew that no every other human being would never be able to reach, yet he had no feeling of superiority over another human being. He was so connected to Hashem, he was so one with Hashem, that he had no ego. And because he had no ego, it made no difference what he had. It made no difference if someone could do a better job, could not do a better job, if he had a level of prophecy, never a level of prophecy. His humility was intrinsic. He never felt he was the greatest person. And in fact, by conclusion, he wasn't only the greatest person which happened to be, but he was the greatest person that could ever have been. Because his prophecy was given to him in a way where no other human being could have ever reached that level, and yet he felt no feeling of being superior to another person. That's what we call intrinsic humility. Just no feeling of being superior. Why? It comes from being connected to God. It comes from being a feeling of completely oneness with Hashem. When you're one with Hashem, there is no room for ego. If there is no room for ego, there's no room for feeling superior to other people. There's no sense of self. It doesn't mean there's no sense of strength, but that strength is a God-given strength. Right? There's a big difference between sense of strength and sense of self. Sense of self is arrogance. Sense of strength is a good thing. I.e. healthy sense of self. Healthy sense of self comes actually from a connection to Hashem. Healthy, as we've talked many times, healthy sense of self comes from humility actually, not from arrogance. Healthy sense of self means that my strength is because I'm connected to something much greater than me. I'm connected to the infinity of Hashem. And that's why I have that strength. So my strength is much more stronger than I think it is. But that doesn't breed arrogance. Now, for most people, to reach this imperfection is very difficult. Moshe Rabbeinu was the most humble, meaning he had intrinsic humility. He didn't feel any superiority to everyone else. This is a word that's written, but I want to connect it to another beautiful word, which fits in so beautifully to something that the Knesset Yecheskel says. I'll tell you the Knesset Yecheskel is just out of interest. There's a rabbi that comes here to collect funds very often. He used to come with his father, the Deja Ruv. You ever met him? Rabbi Panet, his name is. Right? He's a descendant. This is the Knesset Yecheskel is one of the first Deja Rebbe, I think it was. He says the following. He quotes a very interesting medrash, and it's on your at the bottom of your handout. So it says like this: and Moshe Rabbeinu was the most humble, Mikol Ha'odom Asher. You see that last line? From all people that was. So there's a very cryptic medrash. Mikol Ha'odom, see the word, it's a play on words. The word Mikol can mean more than, right? He was most humble than the. So Mikol Ha'odom from, but it could also mean from, right? From all the people or than all the people on earth. Says the medrash, Mikol Ha'odom Asher. Moshe Rabbeinu was the most humble Mikol Ha'odom from all people, but V'loy Min Ha'ovos. Now it seems to be reading that he wasn't more humble than the patriarchs. Not from the fathers, Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov. Which is very strange, because that doesn't seem to fit into the pasuk. Right? If you read just the Medrash simply, it seems to say, Moshe Rabbeinu was the most humble than all, if you translate the prefix mem as than, so he was most humble than all other people, but not than the Avos. Which means he was less humble than the Avos, which also suddenly contradicts everything we know about Moshe Rabbeinu. Right? The whole idea is that Moshe Rabbeinu was the most humble person. So he gives a whole nother pshat that the prefix mem in the first sentence and the prefix mem in the second sentence means something different. And let me explain to you. He quotes a very interesting Gemara. He says, You know the Yitzchak and Rivka. Well, Yitzchak and Rivka davened for a child, right? It says they were davening each one in the corner. It was 10 years. Yitzchak and Rivka hadn't had a children yet, so they put themselves in a corner and they both davened. And it says Hashem answered him, and not her. Hashem answered him. It means he answered Yitzchak. It seems like he answered Yitzchak quicker than answered Rivka, right? Says the Gemara. From here we learn that the tefillah, the prayer of a tzaddik, who's the son of a tzaddik, is greater than the prayer of a tzaddik who's the son of a wicked person, or child of a wicked person. Okay. Now Yitzchak was a tzaddik, a son of a tzaddik. His father was Avraham Avinu, Yichus. Rivka was a daughter of Besuel, not a great guy. So therefore Yitzchak's tefillah was greater. He asked the question, doesn't this go against whatever we taught? On the contrary. Who's greater? Who's greater? Someone who inherited greatness or someone who had to fight for greatness? You'd imagine that someone had to fight for greatness is greater. It should be the other way around. Rivka's davening should be greater. So he says like this. He says, no. When it comes to what's greater, what will get the most reward, what is more precious perhaps in the eyes of Hashem, no question. Someone who's a tzaddik, the son of a wicked person, is greater than someone who's a tzaddik that is a son of a tzaddik. Because to fight for that struggle, to overcome that struggle of coming from evil and yet achieving greatness is definitely greater than coming from greatness and achieving greatness. That's true on all levels, except for davening. Why? For your davening to be answered, one of the ingredients of davening to be answered is humility. Humility. To be humble. It's quicker for someone who's a son of a righteous person to be humble than the son of a wicked person. Why? At the end of the day, the tzaddik, who's a son of a tzaddik, knows they're a tzaddik, but they also know that they didn't work for it. Right? So when it comes to davening, it's easy to feel, who am I at the end of the day? Ah, I'm a great guy, I'm a great tzaddik. Yeah, but my father was a great tzaddik, so big deal. Whereas someone who davens as a tzaddik, who is the son or a daughter of a wicked person, subtly it could be that it could creep in that I'm a tzaddik, but you know, me being a tzaddik is pretty great. Like, I had to achieve this, right? So the chances of pure humility is less than a tzaddik who inherited greatness. The person might be greater, but the humility is a little bit less. Okay? And that's why the tefillah of a tzaddik, the son of a tzaddik, is quicker because they're more humble. He says like this, Moshe Rabbeinu, we are told, is humble. So we need to see, where does this humility come from? So it could be that it comes from being descendant of the Ovis. Maybe that's part of the Moshe Rabbeinu's cheshbon, part of the Moshe Rabbeinu's calculation. I'm not so great. At the end of the day, there were great ones came before me. Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov. I'm great. Yes, I'm great, but it's not me. I was given this. Right? That's possible. That's possibly one source of Moshe Rabbeinu's humility. Says the Torah, when it came to Moshe Rabbeinu, it wasn't like that. Why? Because as we said before, Moshe Rabbeinu's humility was intrinsic. It wasn't an inherited and it wasn't a rational humility. It was an intrinsic humility. And that's why even though he was the greatest person, he was completely humble. And that's what the Medrash means. Look at the Medrash again. The Ish Moshe, Onav Moed, Moshe Rabbeinu was the most humble, Mikol Ha'odam Asher, than all people, that's what the Mem means there, than all people on the earth, says the Medrash, V'loi Min Ha'avos, not, this time it means from, and not from the forefathers. It didn't come, his humility didn't come from Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov, like it does in the case of a tefillah, which is a tzaddik, the son of a tzaddik. His humility was not derived from being a children of tzaddikim. Why? Because his humility was intrinsic. It was intrinsic because it came from his connection to Hashem, the oneness with Hashem. That's what it means. He was more humble than any person that could have ever lived or he will live. Why? Because it's intrinsic. What do you mean intrinsic? It wasn't a rational thing. It wasn't a gift from his ancestors. It was an intrinsic humility which he achieved by being completely one with Hashem. Okay, stop there.